This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
I like the program beats. Diamond D is out. I want to say pay. Show biz, there's deals to make. So let's get busy and dig in the crates.
I don't stop. You keep on
digging in the crates. Let's get busy.
Keep on
digging in the crates.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 3. Of the Digging in the Crates podcast on the Place to Be Nation podcasting network. I am your host, Phil Schneider. I am here with my good friend and fellow contributor to Segunda Caída blog, Eric Ritz. Say hello, Eric.
Hey, buddy. Good to be back podcasting again.
That's right. Many years ago, we did a quasi-regular, by quasi-regular, like sometimes twice a month, sometimes once every 4 months, podcast where we made lots of jokes and talked about a whole bunch of nothing with a bunch of doofs on
a bunch of people talking over each other and trying to get their jokes in and
like one of those early podcast things where we all called in and the sound was really bad.
Everybody
sounded that was a long time, and now I'm back with something on like a podcasting network, like a real live boy.
This, called
Eric for episode 3.
Yeah, these podcasts are the clearest I've ever heard your voice outside of standing right next to you.
I know. Even that, it's not as clear.
I'm so used to, I know. Well, then I gotta deal with chewing sounds and all other stuff. This is filtering out that noise. Right now, this is, I'm so used to hearing you on speakerphone, dealing with a dog, hearing police sirens in the background, like,
my Jewy sinus voice. So for people that don't, for people that are listening to this for the first time, true Eric Ritz stands. They aren't going to listen to anything that he's not on.
Yeah, just my
audience needs bringing. The conceit of this podcast is we are constructing an old school Schneider comp on air. And we're picking a bunch of matches that I think are pretty cool, that are a little under the radar, thus digging in the crates. I got a guest each week. We're going to talk about watch the matches and talk about them. I can talk about why I like them. My guest can talk about why he liked them or did not like them, whatever the case may be. So we got 4 pretty cool matches this week that we're going to talk about, and I think we'll just jump right into it.
Chronological, right? Let's just do chronological. I think, although that'll end. that means the third match would be like the greatest match ever, and the fourth one would be like kind of a fun, goofy match. But I don't mind if we just do chronological.
Chronological is fine with me. I should probably establish some sort of criteria for this that remains consistent on the
chronological is a fairly good
chronological. It is. This is a work in progress, everyone. This is like an open source document. We're creating this together. This podcast.
Episode 27 will be just the same.
It's a Joe Swanberg. It's like a Joe Swanberg movie. There's a plot, but mostly it's just riffing.
King of the references. I'm loving this.
All right. So the first match, chronologically, which one was first? The two of them were from 1979, right?
Yeah, well, let's do the... let's start with Wahoo.
All right. So this match is Wahoo McDaniel and the Spoiler... And it is from a date in history. And that date in history is in the year 1979. Jimmy Carter was president. America was going through the Iran hostage crisis. Gas lines. Malaise.
9/11 in 22 years.
So it is April 21st, 1979. This is from Houston, Texas.
Houston, Texas.
Part of the incredible, unbelievable, spectacular NWA Classic Service, which if you are going to waste an hour listening to me talk about weird, obscure wrestling, then you absolutely should waste $9 a month on subscribing to NWA Classics. It is just an absolute gold mine of cool previously unseen, unavailable matches in gorgeous video quality, like you never see from video quality from footage this old. This match was sort of the exception because I think they had a camera issue.
One of the three cameras was fuzzy, but not even fuzzy. It just kind of made everybody look like their trunks had vertical stripes.
Yeah, which was, I think, an issue of the technology of 1979, not of the footage itself. So
Gary Hart had a gray suit, which just looked like a pinstripe suit in this. Yeah. So that's not a big deal. We've all watched like 12 times worse quality.
Oh, my first comp tape I ever bought, 70% of the matches were just blue screen with noise.
Yeah, I got a Sabu compilation tape, which I think was just tracking. Like 6 hours of tracking. So that was my first tape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think everybody's first tape in the 90s was a Sabu tape.
I don't think there's actually a 6 hour Sabu VHS compilation out there. It's all just blank tapes that we got duped into buying.
Like Trump University. just this huge Ponzi scheme. Like what?
I just verbally realized I've been a sucker for Oh my gosh. Breakthrough.
So this match was 2 out of 3 falls. It was for a U.S. title. Or it was the U.S. title.
I don't remember the title. No matter what the title was, it's completely trumped by Wahoo's pre-match interview where he says he wants the belt because Indians like shiny things.
Yeah, that was funny. You know, us Indians, we like fire, water, and trinkets. That's how we lost Manhattan.
What's great is he says the joke and it gets kind of like no-sold. And so then he really drives the joke home again to make sure that, like, people hear it.
It's really weird because this clearly wasn't, you know, like, oh, man, you know, Vince McMahon wants to give Tatanka a gimmick of an Indian casino owner. And Tatanka's in his 40s and wants a paycheck, so he'll just, you know, embrace it. You know, like, it's not one of those things where it's, like, clearly this racist gimmick by like some out of touch white guy. I mean, this is clearly Wahoo just freestyling bigotry.
You know my idiot race. We like just self-loathing to close out the promo with a little bit of self-racial loathing here.
I mean, you know, I've made a Jew joke or two in my day. I guess it's not completely unprecedented, but it was weird. This is an aside, but it does actually fit in with what's going on. Wahoo is being interviewed by Paul Bosch, who's the promoter of Houston.
Right.
This is all his footage that was, I guess, bought by his wife owns and made a deal with NWA to release. He apparently worked as an ethnic babyface in the mold of like Pedro Morales or Bruno, except he was an ethnic Jewish babyface.
Really?
Yes, but it turned, and his sort of secret was exposed when somebody saw him in the shower.
Oh my God.
Realized that, wait a minute.
So this is the mythology of somebody seeing Carrie's, the water spilling out of Carrie's boot is the hooded penis of Paul Bosch.
The foreskinned penis of Paul Bosch. That was how somebody lost the beat. That's how somebody realized that the kayfabe was the death of kayfabe.
So in the wrestling museum of
Michelle,
the wrestling museum in Poughkeepsie has like Carrie's foot and Paul Bosch's force. Just on a bunch of wrestling controversies all in one case. that's terrible.
So when I reviewed this match, the match that I think it reminded me the most of was MS1 versus Sangre Chicana, the hair match from 1983, which I think is the greatest wrestling match of all time.
Right.
Because that same sort of thing where Spoiler just comes out and takes the entirety of the first 5 minutes of this match. And, you know, just with a lot of, like, forearms to the neck and, you know, and really, really, really nasty stomps to the head. And just, but, and, you know, but, like, and Boss even breaks out my favorite old Lance Russell commentary about Waller, where he calls, you know, Wild McDaniel a notoriously slow starter.
Yeah, Boss drops that one, like, 5 times in this match.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. It's my favorite call. And you have the same sort of thing where it's like the single Wahoo chop, which opens up the match and gives him a little more room.
Mm-hmm. Backs off Spoiler a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like this match quite a bit. I admittedly was a little let down because it's tough when somebody compares. This reminded me of MS1 Sangre Chicana. Like that's tough. That's tough to go in with that as your compass point. I had not seen Spoiler a whole lot. In fact, I think the Spoiler I've seen was from, didn't he work like mid-80s WWF?
Maybe.
I'm pretty sure like mid, you know, he was like probably late, mid to late 40s at that point, but I'm positive I've seen some mid-80s WWF
this
stuff.
This is why we need to, like, have Chris Zellner be an intern.
Yeah, Chris Zellner can just hang out. Or
just hang out and just jump in and correct us.
Anybody listening to us is already on Cage Match, and they see it, and they know if I'm right or wrong. But I'm pretty positive I've seen that. And so I never really – so I was not too familiar with him before, and I really liked certain things. He had some of the best stomps that I've seen, and a worked stomp is really hard to make look good without making it look like you're just trying to bounce on a mat.
Yeah.
And he, I think his worked stomps were good because he wasn't clearly just kicking Wahoo in the face. He was actually working a stomp.
Yeah, like I'm going to aim this one towards this point of the jaw, and I'm going to see if I can mess with his equilibrium by hitting him in his eardrum, and then I'm going to put this one in the rabbit part of his head.
Yeah.
And each stomp had its own little place to be.
Yeah, and then as Wahoo's rolling out of the ring, you actually get him, you get him stomping out after hands, you get him stomping in the side of the head. It was really cool. Yes. And then I just want to kind of bucket in a few different Spoiler things that I thought were cool.
Oh, please. No spoilers.
No Jardines. No Jardines, please.
We don't want a spoiler.
We don't want to Jardine this. I don't know who. I don't know if Omar died yet. No Jardines. And I love the match. Really got going for me. So I was kind of. I've never really seen a guy do this before. This is a spot that I saw that you never really think about looking bad until somebody does it, like the Spoiler, and you go, "Oh, everybody else who's ever done this has made it look horrible." And that is when he spilled out to the floor after Wahoo first started getting his big offensive run, and then he yanked Wahoo out under the ropes onto the floor in a way that I'm so sorry, everybody. Wahoo
this
clearly
would not
didn't
nearly think. As good if this was Spoiler versus Wahoo Serious.
Oh gosh. Yes. Oh gosh. I'm paid 5 cents on the dollar every time I name drop Wahoo. So
that's up as marketing for Wahoo.
Yeah, I do this as a side gig, and so it's kind of seeped into my brain in regular conversation, so I apologize. But when Jardine yanked Wahoo to the floor, Wahoo did not look like a man who was ready to get yanked to a ring floor. And usually they're very tentative spots, and it's very much a brief moment of like, all right, I'm going to hold you, and you're going to get out of this ring, and then we're going to resume brawling. But this was like just Wahoo getting his legs grabbed, and both of them just pulled out from under him and right under the ropes, right onto the floor. And really kind of added to the immediacy and the fight feel. And right after that, Wahoo takes a crazy face-first bump right into the ring post. And a ring post bump is something that's hard to make look good unless you're Stan Hansen or Jerry Lawler, and Wahoo just flies right into it face-first. And from there on out, the match is pretty terrific.
I think one of the reasons Wahoo's really good at taking wing post bumps is because he's got such a wide face.
It is a wide face, and it's a big
lot, it's a lot of face to hit a turnbuckle.
That the pre-match interview with Bosch is just, like, 3 minutes of it is just a close-up side angle on just big Wahoo meaty face. Like, it is just, we needed to pull back a little bit, because it is just a zoom in right on that craggly, like, busted up meaty face. And, but it was good. The match was really fun, and I did think Wahoo did have the most obvious blade job this side of Abdullah when Jardine was really great because he was hiding, you know, hinting at a hidden weapon in his mask before Bosch was even talking about it.
Right.
And so Jardine, I could see kind of adjust his mask, and I said, oh, is he going to do some fake weapon headbutts? And right after that, he blasts Wahoo with a headbutt, who then proceeds to wipe the back of his brow in a long, slow motion as if he was a Southern lawyer about to make an appeal for his client in the courtroom. I figure if I see a blade job, I'm pretty oblivious to those things, then it must be the most obvious blade job ever. But I don't care. I don't care because blood.
Nice. He bled a lot. That was pretty great.
Yeah, it's pretty terrific that he bled a lot. And he's willing to put over a gimmicked mask, which and Bosch was really great at doing a slow burn on like a I'm not entirely sure. There's not a weapon in that mask.
Yeah, something looks a mess.
Yeah. So I like that kind of stuff.
I love the finish of this. I mean, what a great piece of horseshit wrestling finish.
Oh, that's some quality bullshit pro wrestling stuff right there.
I mean, the basic finish of this match is that Spoilers locks in the Iron Claw. He's a great Iron Claw worker. There's actually a really good, like, sort of mid-Atlantic house show clips of these two in another match against each other. It's got a lot of really great claw stuff and a really fun finish. It's not a whole match. It's, you know, you only get the last 6 minutes and then clips of the beginning parts, but they've got a whole bunch of stuff where, like, Spoilers got him in the claw and he holds on as Wahoo throws him around and stuff. Spoilers got a guy after even just two matches of his is really creative, got a bunch of stuff with the claw.
Well, they also did a really good job of establishing Gary Hart helping Spoiler with his claw. You know, there's a little glove, and then at one point, Hart's kind of coming in and rubbing the glove with his thumb, and so is he putting rosin on it? You know, and the ref is smelling Gary Hart's hands and smelling the glove to see if,
I think it's resin. You
know. Yeah.
Isn't it resin?
Right. Yeah, some resin.
You're having some pronunciation issues on this podcast.
What did I say? Did I say resin?
You said rosin.
resin. It's like this. That's the same thing. A rosin bag in baseball is what you know.
He put some raisins on his glove.
Those things are one and the same. That is one vowel difference, but the same thing. It's to get a grip on things.
Sure. You know,
to accentuate. Grip strength.
Spoiler! The claw!
That was so loud. That was mic'd incredibly. I thought Gary Hart was standing behind me when I heard that. He shouts that from the heavens. Use the claw! And,
So the end of the match, Spoiler's got the claw and Wahoo was bleeding. Wahoo counters it by turning around the Spoiler's mask.
Right.
So the Spoiler is now blind. And then he just starts clawing everybody.
He goes crazy and flips out and is going to claw anybody that gets in his path. I love, you had pointed out, Wahoo's one big shot, you know, his big chop that can get some distance between him and his opponent. I like his variations on chops, and I especially want to point out how beautiful his running, diving, almost chop fist drop looked.
Oh, yeah.
Where Spoiler was prone on his back, and then Wahoo just ran and just tomahawked, but he kind of did it in like a falling DiBiase style, but quick. And so he just hit this nasty falling tomahawk chop, but like a fist drop. And then Danny McShane did the most awkward pinfall count in history, where he just kind of drapes himself over Wahoo's buttocks and like kind of creeps in for the count right after that. We get a nice zoom in on that. But no, this match was fun. This was, you know, Wahoo's a guy that not a lot of this 70s stuff of Wahoo exists, so this is all exciting stuff, and I've never seen a 2 out of 3 falls spoiler match. Spoiler is a guy looks like a huge guy.
Yeah.
So seeing him here, very agile for such a large guy. He kind of took silly bumps off of Wahoo chops, but you know, you got to put over the chops in some way, and he kind of acted like his legs were just completely swept under him, like he was turned ass over elbow just from getting chopped by Wahoo. So kind of dig that stuff. But the guy moves really quick for such a large man.
He gets to the top rope fast.
Yeah, that's true. I noticed that. No, he's really much quicker than I thought. Also, any idea why he wore a mask? He seems like, in looking up maskless photos of him, he looks like a very normal, non-hideous man.
I did not know. I think he wants his privacy. I think he wants to live a normal life outside of the wrestling world. He prefers his privacy.
Huh. He obviously does not prefer his health. Yeah. So, but I love certain masks. Pardon?
That was always what the assassin used to say when anybody asked him, "Why are you with a mask?"
I mean,
I'm a private man. I like to have a family life.
That's not insane. That works both in a pro wrestling context and in an actual real life context.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense. But I really like mask removal spots because they always look really painful to me. And we get a few really good mask removal attempts from Wahoo, where Wahoo yanks the spoiler's mask up into his, you know, teeth. And so Wahoo's still pulling on the mask, and it looks like it's really, like, you know, kind of double fish-hooking spoiler in the mouth, you know, just, I don't know. I really like mask removal stuff.
Yeah, the finish of the other match they have, these guys have with each other on YouTube, the one I was mentioning, is really cool that way, where Wahoo counters the claw by pulling off the spoiler's mask, and the spoiler simultaneously pulls off the referee's shirt to cover his own face when the mask gets removed, which is really cool.
That's great.
Spoiler feels like a guy who put some thought into some stuff. Like he's a guy with some shtick. Just the two matches. Or Wahoo's got shtick. But Wahoo does never seem to be like a shtick guy.
No.
So maybe Spoiler's a guy with some of you. Like it feels like there's Spoiler and Bill Dundee would have a really great match where it would, you know, would require a lot of athleticism.
It feels like those little things that Finley would always do, like when he comes back to WWE. It felt like for a while Finley just wanted to come back to WWE because he thought of trapping a guy in an apron skirt.
Yeah.
Like he thought of that and he's like, I need to do this. I'm not telling one other soul about this. Only I will get to do this spot. But Finley always came up with cool stuff like that. That, you know, stuff that within your surroundings you're using in a way that nobody's used before. I've never heard of that spot that you just mentioned, and that's amazing.
Dick Murdoch was always really good at that too, where I remember there was a tournament that New Japan ran when we were doing the 80 set that was all about, or one of the ways people could be eliminated is getting knocked off the apron to the floor. It was like elimination 6-man tags.
Uh-huh.
And Dick Murdoch was on one of the teams, and he worked 15 new wrestling spots built upon this thing that had never existed wrestling before.
Yeah, probably only because a camera was turned on.
Yeah, fucking, all right. Well, let's go to our next match. Still also in 1979.
Right.
This was a match that was part of this sort of random set of All Japan downloads that was... sort of, I think, discovered on YouTube by our friend Matt D, who also wrote Segunda Kaita.
Right.
On a podcast at some point, where he sort of found this, found this this guy from Japan who was downloading a ton of 80s All Japan stuff that we had not previously seen.
Not seen most of before.
And this isn't from 1979. Forget it. This is from 1981. It's from March 81.
Perfect. Perfect. That was 2 months after my birth.
All right. Okay. I was five. I'm a little older than you.
Yes.
This is Giant Baba versus Killer Carl Cox from March 1981 for the PWF title. And this, as far as I know, hadn't been, and no one in who traded tapes had seen this before August 9th, 2015, when this guy threw this up on YouTube.
Yeah, and this is, I loved this match. I love it. I am a big fan of KKK.
Sure. We're just going to cut that and just cut that one little thing and just send it to your bosses at work.
Send that out, right.
Yeah, the KKK guy.
It is weird that I don't know much about Killer Carl Cox. I don't know. There doesn't seem to appear tons of easily available footage out there, although I'm sure some people have seen more. I've probably seen maybe three matches of him. It is unnerving that he actually wears a track jacket that says KKK across the back. That doesn't seem not accidental, you know? And this is, weirdly, his second-to-last match. His last two matches, this is bizarre to me. I'd love to know the story behind this. So this is his last match in Japan, and it's a 2-out-of-3-falls match, and it's for Baba's title. And then his last match was a year and a half later, back in the States, against Andre. So it's not like he petered out and worked like, you know, a buddy's show. Like, he clearly was brought back as a huge, I mean, Andre in, you know, 1982, that's a big draw to put a guy against in a singles match.
And I bet that was good.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. That sounds so great. So we might just talk about that.
Let's work in Mid-South, because I'd seen a couple of matches of his in the early Mid-South stuff when we were doing the Mid-South stuff. I don't think any of them made the Mid-South stuff, but that's where I had seen him before.
Well, what I love about this match is I'm a big fan of old guy fights. That's the thing I think we share, but that's definitely one of my tropes. I really love old man fights in wrestling. And this is a great old guy fight. Cox is probably 50, but looks probably a little older than 50 in this match. And, but he's just an old grouchy badass. And I love some of these older Gaijin seem to have no problem really taking it to Baba. Whereas you see a lot of natives kind of ease off on Baba, you get guys like Stan Hansen murdering Giant Baba pretty regularly. Stan Hansen regularly kicks the hell out of Giant Baba. And Cox is no different. Cox has some of the greatest elbow-based offense, a lot of hard elbows, a lot of great back elbows, and great elbow drops. And there's a couple elbow drops that he does. And Baba has, you know, his giant, crazy rib cage and sternum. And Cox just looks like he is trying to just break Baba's rib cage, yeah, like right
that,
down the middle.
That was what I remember thinking, exactly the same thing when I watched this. It's like, man, those elbows look like they're really, really going to injure this fragile-looking man.
Yeah. Baba looks so brittle so much of the time. He has to be more of a badass than anybody could ever imagine, because he has taken some beatings in matches that I've watched. But Cox, like, laces in to Baba with these elbows. And Baba looks so fragile and so broken. And then, I love matches where guys blade for Baba's chops.
Yeah.
Abdullah the Butcher is always really great at that because Abdullah will have no problem like blading his ear open when Baba chops him in the side of the head, because Abdullah the Butcher's stupid and awesome. And so I love Baba fires back with really nice looking chops. I'm a fan of Baba chops. I'm a pretty big Giant Baba fan in general.
Yeah,
I'm sure I'm sure some joyless crap sacks don't like Giant Baba, but I'm
this
out.
This is still the point where Giant Baba was spry enough that he could, you know, do some stuff. He was still fun when he wasn't spry enough to be able to do anything.
Yeah.
But early 80s, he was, you know, I don't think he was in his athletic prime, but he was...
It is shocking. One of the revelations with this weird All Japan uploads was just how quickly Baba and Rusher Kimura went from kind of spry, muscular men to elderly old men. I mean, it was like overnight. I think I watched two of their matches, and in one of them, Rusher Kimura looks like Masa Saito. He's just this barrel chest, huge dude. And 3 years later, he is old Rusher Kimura. You know, like really old, broken, not able to move very fast Rusher Kimura, which he then proceeded to be for the next, you know, 10 years. But yeah, I love Cox hitting the blade off of the Baba chops. And even more, I love Cox playing hide the weapon in a PWF title match in Japan for Baba's title. I don't think I've ever seen some old guy work a hidden weapon match, an old white guy working a singles title match against Baba, hiding a weapon from Joe Higuchi. And the fans love it, and after the match, Baba gets presented with his 8-foot-tall, ridiculously, you know, blowjob trophies, you know? Like a kind of trophy you imagine Triple H making for himself. You know, like a trophy that takes like 6 dudes to lift into the ring and then is as tall as Baba when they're standing in the ring. Yeah. Like you can just imagine Triple H demanding people, demanding some crew members lug these things from town to town to keep in his office. And I just love it. I love old man fights. I loved every second of this. It's really short for a 2 out of 3 falls match. The whole thing is probably 10 minutes long, but
it's a little joint in progress. We may miss
right
2 or 3 minutes in the beginning, probably not much more than that, if not even that much. It looks like I was trying to think of the Killer Carl Cox Mid-South run. It looks like that was earlier in 81. So this is right after he was a weirdly a JYD tag partner, which could not have gone over well.
Oh my
practice.
Gosh. Bill Watts, everybody.
Yeah. Killer Carl Cox, KKK, and the Junkyard Dog, and they were feuding with Ernie Ladd and Leroy Brown. I don't know what the politics of that was. Was he working a like a Nation of Islam gimmick where, you know, like how where it's like, hey, you know, at least I know what this, at least this KKK guy speaks his mind.
Well, you know,
like this black Republican Ernie Ladd.
If it's I mean, really, in a kayfabe sense, if you're choosing a tag partner and you're going up against two black guys, you're like, well, I know this guy's going to hate those two. I know this guy. He's technically not on my side, but there's two of those guys, so he's definitely going to be against them. So, I don't know. I'd love to hear the commentary from that match. But yeah, this kind of adds to our little mini Killer Carl Cox legacy, of which we've already determined he had the greatest match of 76, right? Or 77 with he and Murdoch.
I know we're back to an aside here, but I'm looking as this feud continues after Cox leaves. JYD, in his feud against Ernie Ladd and Leroy Brown, JYD then picks up Buck Robley and then picks up Dick Murdoch. So it really feels like he lost from KKK and then went to the other guys in the KKK.
He's then going to the Sergeant at Arms, and then he's going to like the Treasurer. And
although I do not know, I'm sure it's possible Buck Robley had very progressive racial views on racial politics. I do not know that. Dick Murdoch, there's been some rumors.
Dick Murdoch is one of those like, oh, there's smoke, you know, there's, I get it.
Buck Robley could be it. I mean, he could have been like, he has the look of maybe like an old hippie. You go either way.
I always thought Buck Robley got mistaken for being Asian. He always wore those "Don't Call Me Yellow" shirts.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
Oh, come on, come on! You worked in your Paul Bosch shower joke.
Don't call me yellow. That's horrible. All right. On that note, so our next match is. Give me a date on this one, Aaron.
It's sometime late, or early. This is January of 87?
January of 87. And it's, Carlos Colon versus Stan Hansen in a bull rope match.
Yeah.
From Puerto Rico. I believe, Roberto Clemente Stadium. It looks like Roberto Clemente Stadium.
Yeah, it does.
And it is awesome.
It's the best. I mean, there's so many things you could say about it, but flat out, like, it's the best. It's the coolest thing.
And I think when we put up links to the YouTube clips of this match, we'll put up the entire the entire feud on YouTube, and you can watch.
The best 90 minutes you'll spend.
Yeah, all of it's good. Like. I think, you know, when people talk about Hansen, it's like here's Hansen one of the great wrestlers of all time. It's almost always on his Japan stuff.
Right.
Because, I don't know how much great Stan Hansen, in America stuff we really have.
There is not a lot of American Stan Hansen that I love, but the Japanese Stan Hansen is arguably my absolute favorite wrestler.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy that comes out swinging his lasso, punching ring boys, and then just running through opponents while also somehow managing to seem vulnerable and totally selling for guys that deserve it. I mean, he is like pro wrestling. When I can show anybody who's not even a fan of pro wrestling but is curious about it, I'm positive I show them 10 minutes of All Japan Stan Hansen, they'll understand what I enjoy about pro wrestling. The guy has such an aura and such, like, the guy just seems like the coolest guy in the building. The guy is just the hottest badass possible. So I get it. Yeah. Japan Stan Hansen. Amazing. And I'd never seen Puerto Rico Stan Hansen, which there can't be much of. I can't imagine he had tons of time to just go down to Puerto Rico.
I think that was a spot he worked. I think he had some other stuff with Brody. I mean, I think had some Abby stuff. I don't know how much of it exists. I mean, obviously this is your big feud, right, over the course of 86 and 87.
It's the best. It's a gimmick match, and there's other non-gimmick matches, but Puerto Rico Stan Hansen, after watching this set of, what is it, 6 matches? He was down there like one match per month for 6 months, right?
Or at least we have him on tape, I don't know.
At least available to see.
On other islands or something. I'm not really sure how the Puerto Rican territorial system worked.
Right. Based on this video, this timeline. It's a slightly different Stan Hansen. It's kind of fascinating to see how he works the Puerto Rico crowd differently than he works the Japanese crowd.
Well, I think if you go into the Puerto Rican crowd swinging your bull rope around, stick a 6-inch switchblade in your ribs.
I'm not expecting him to go through the and just punch ring boys. I'm saying in terms of within a match and within his in-match interactions with the crowd. Whereas you got the vibe during his All Japan stuff that he knew he was king shit during his matches, you know, and the fans knew it, the fans fed off it, and he knew how to react to the crowd. In this one, you see almost him doing some bullshit Memphis stuff and kind of clownish reactions to the crowd, like that I've never really seen from him before.
I mean, one of the cool things about Puerto Rican wrestling is it when you have these great, like, heated brawls, I mean, it always feels on the verge of a riot.
Yes.
Like, it always feels like we're moments away from just everyone in the crowd trying to kill each other.
Yeah.
It's like Lucha shows, too, but and occasionally I've seen it in some, like, there were some SNW shows with the gangsters where it really felt like, you know, we were moments away from that. Right. It's certainly not the sense that you see in wrestling anymore. And
no.
It's really, really, really awesome when it feels like you've just got this crowd where they're just right at the point where somebody's going to bump into somebody and then, you know, spill the guy's beer a little bit, and then just the entire thing is going to interrupt into a murderous frenzy.
Yeah. And the match itself is just violent while being the smartest possibly worked bull rope match, four corners match that I have ever seen. It's something you watch and I cannot possibly imagine it being done better than these two do it.
Is this better than Piper Valentine and Sting Vader?
Sting Vader is fascinating because you get little touches like Vader blading his chest, and it's notable because it's probably my absolute favorite Sting match when you talk about guys that I really don't care a lot about. Valentine Piper is, gosh, that's a tough one with the chain. It's tough to compare because it is apples and oranges because these guys don't get to use the chain, and I'm sure they could have integrated a chain really nicely into this match. But for getting over the stipulation of touching the four corners itself, these two guys did it completely believably. There was no stupid, slow tags. Oh, I'm reaching out. If only I can muster the strength to go one more foot. There was none of that. Every time a guy was getting close, there looked to be actual physical muscle-straining struggle from both men. And it was so powerful. The one image that I think is one of the more awesome things I've seen in wrestling is Cologne on his back, Hansen going for the final turnbuckle, and Cologne using all the leverage he can get from his back, both arms flexed completely, pulling the rope like as taut as he possibly can, trying to leverage up with his legs, and Stan Hansen also looking like he is using all of his strength to try and get, you know, closer to the turnbuckle. It looked like, I mean, somebody could have slipped and Hansen could have gone barreling face fucking first right into the turnbuckle, you know? And
where he Hansen reaches out and then falls backwards and he just screams to the gods, like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible. It's stuff that that makes sense when you see it and you wonder why has nobody else done this, and it's just probably because nobody else could, because Stan Hansen's the best and Carlos Colon is also really amazing. And
so good. He's got a bad rep because Brody and all that shit, but
right.
Carlos Colon is good.
I mean, it was a perfect match for me. This was perfect. And it's not just the heat from the crowd, which is, obviously everybody that's watched Puerto Rico knows that it's just a whole different ball game. I mean, it's just different. Everything there seems different, and it puts a whole different vibe through every match there, and especially a kind of match like this. And everything about this match was great. There were so many different unique ways of getting to the turnbuckles and interrupting the guys on their ways to the turnbuckles. It's great. It's just a perfectly done, perfectly executed, amazing match. It's the best.
Yeah, I mean, as far as working a gimmick in a wrestling match, because that's what this was. It was, really was, like the perfect use of a gimmick.
Yeah.
As the structure of the match, right? It's not like a match and they're in a cage and the cage is there.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's ever been done this good.
No, I don't think it has. This wasn't just Stan Hansen and Cologne working, because we you know, there's two normal singles matches, some non-gimmick matches on here, and they work entirely different.
Yeah.
This wasn't just them working their match oh, and there also is a bull rope involved that we have to tag the turnbuckles. This was them working a bull rope match, like fully embracing the gimmick. This is, to me, as good, and this was why it was my favorite match on the Memphis set, is the 3 out of 5 falls scaffold match with Bill Dundee and Sweet Brown Sugar.
I don't think it was 3 out of 5.
Is it? Wasn't it 3 out of 5?
It was 2 out of 5.
2 out of 3, yeah.
5 times.
Yeah, that's a lot of falls. But the way Bill Dundee used his skills to integrate, that both men used their personalities and their skill sets to perfectly integrate this impossible to integrate thing into a match. Scaffold's only good for one thing, falling off of. Yet they somehow made a beautiful match out of this, and that's what Cologne and Hansen did with this bull rope, which how many times have I seen I've seen several matches where the bull rope match in a feud is the weakest part of the match because the guys are kind of hamstrung by the gimmick. And this is the guys just taking the gimmick to the highest possible level. It's the best. It's awesome.
Yeah, I would really love to see. I mean, it feels like this had to be a Stan Hansen match, right?
Yes.
He was going against Austin Idol, too, right? Obviously, he's not working Masao in a bull rope match. Three, but I mean, he must have toured with this, right?
Yeah, I mean, this seems like a pretty fitting gimmick match for him, you know?
Yeah, it has to be like, you know, he has to have had bull rope matches with tons of dudes, you know, over Tommy Rich and Mr. Wrestling 2. So it just feels like, man, you want to see all of them. Because you watch this and go, wow, this is a guy who, you know, has this particular set of skills perfectly.
He was so good in this gimmick match that it made me want to see him in every kind of gimmick match. It made me like, what would Stan Hansen versus Undertaker in a Buried Alive match be like? Like, I'm so confident at this point, Stan Hansen could just... What's a blindfold match like with Stan Hansen? I mean, real answer is every Stan Hansen match is already a blindfold match. But that's the truth. But he was so perfect in this that it just made me think there is literally no kind of match that he wouldn't just somehow be able to perfect.
One of those... I guess he had one against Luger, right, in 90. I have to rewatch that.
Which I've never seen. I've never seen any of his WCW run. And because I've never been into... It's so weird. I've never really encountered a wrestler who I just don't... I love as much as Stan Hansen, yet every time I see his American stuff, it just does nothing for me. Like any of his aura that he has in all of the Japanese stuff I watch, which I've watched boatloads of, it's just not there to the same degree in the stateside stuff. I have no idea why that is. Maybe I'm missing out on a few gold matches. I have no idea, but hasn't happened for me yet. But yeah, this match is incredible. This is perfect pro wrestling. Right here.
Yes. And let's go on to something that's definitely pro wrestling.
The definitely pro wrestling, which is not quite as good as Stan Hansen versus Carlos Colon.
But it's very pro wrestling in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Jerry Lawler and Too Much. Do we have a date on this match?
Is from sometime, I would say probably June of 98.
Okay. It's Jerry Lawler and Too Much, which is Brian Christopher and a pre-Scotty Too Hottie.
This is when he was Too Hot Scott Taylor.
Too Hot Scott Taylor. Mm-hmm. Against Bradshaw, Terry Funk, and Dustin Runnels. I don't remember this period of wrestling where he was working as Dustin Runnels.
The Dustin Runnels character was when he had turned his back on the Gold Dust character and was going back to his true self unmasked. So he worked for a while as Dustin Runnels. I think there might have been a Val Venus feud that spanned a bit. It was not long, I don't believe.
Fucking Vince Russo's the worst.
Yeah, because nobody wanted to see him working as Dustin Runnels. Right. Nobody wants to know that his real name is Runnels. Yeah. No one wants him to talk to his dad, Virgil Runnels.
Ugh.
You know, nobody wants that.
What a bag of shit.
But for the most part, the gimmick was kind of used up on the syndicated shows. I know he had some Raw appearances. This might have even been where I think this led to, it was such a, you know, kind of flop that they went back to Goldust pretty quick, which led to Runnels standing in the crowd with a "He's coming back" sign. You remember that?
Fuck, I don't think I was watching wrestling then.
They were pushing it as almost like a religious thing, you know, like he was a corner preacher. He's coming back. He will return. But it all built up to the return of Goldust. So this had to have happened during that period, this match.
Oh, okay. I don't even really remember a 90. When was this your period where Funk was also working as Chainsaw Charlie?
This was after, so he only worked as Chainsaw Charlie for probably a couple of months, like Royal Rumble through to the next pay-per-view and then WrestleMania. And I think sometime after WrestleMania, he just started working as Terry Funk. And him and Foley had a couple of TV matches, a couple of good TV matches. One of them like a big through the arena brawl that got a lot of acclaim. And then Funk, oddly, just 98 was weird. I mean, Terry Funk, old and just in WWF working like shotgun Saturday night matches. And, you know, he had the Mark Henry match that was really good. That was like a 5-minute match that was really fun. And then I think sometime right around this time, Funk started. He had like a team with Bradshaw that had a couple matches, and then he teamed up with Scorpio to work some stuff. Like he and Scorpio worked probably for a few months as a tag team. And they might have even been on a pay-per-view or two, like Funk and Scorpio. Because it was like, you know, Flash Funk, Terry Funk, wah-wah-wah, but he was still going as Too Cold Scorpio.
I don't even remember the period where Too Cold Scorpio was working as Too Cold. I clearly was not watching late 90s WWF.
No. This was, and I was in high school, and WWF was the hottest thing going. And so we were all watching this. So this is all based on memory, because I have not watched any of this stuff since it was on television in 1998. But I seem to remember Funk just, and it's not like he got a send-off. He just kind of disappeared sometime at the end of 1998. But, yeah, he worked with Scorpio for several matches, and then, yeah, I'm surprised you haven't seen the Mick Foley singles matches against Funk.
Those sound vaguely familiar now that you're mentioning them to me.
Yeah, and but this
I think
match,
the idea that it wasn't that those they wanted to run an exploding barbed wire match at WrestleMania.
Like yes,
that was the idea that they pitched that to Vince.
That's the story going around. Yes, I don't know the story behind why Terry Funk actually came back to WWF, though. Like, it seems like a weird guy to bring. I guess if you're trying to capture the hardcore market, you know, I get it. But it seems, I know he was in the Royal Rumble in 97 and then didn't really do anything else. But I'd love to know more info about why they decided to bring him in and then just have him work casual syndicated TV show matches. Yeah.
Well, this was one of them, and it was very fun because, I mean, it really was like this sort of, it felt like kind of a house show match.
Oh, it did.
Than you normally see on TV, right? Like the crowd was crazy into the Texas Trio. You had Lawler and Too Much and Sky Dwight doing all this crazy stooging and horseshit-ish kind of stuff, which you don't think you really saw on televised matches that much.
Yeah, this is, if you watch other shotgun matches or any WWE TV matches from around this time, this, like you said, this feels like a house show match. This, well, what's notable, so all, you know, the three faces in this match, is from Texas, takes place in Texas, and all three of the guys are from Texas, which usually in WWF logic means Jerry Lawler is going over all of them.
Right.
Because you gotta beat down your guys in their hometown, except for some reason WWF decided, let's just make a badass Texas tag team and let them run wild and do exactly what the crowd would want them to see.
Yeah.
Bradshaw. The opposite.
He must have been, for some reason, like, he just got so excited to be working with, like, Terry Funk as a tag partner, because he was about as energetic as I've ever seen him. He was just running around just killing people with clotheslines.
You talking Bradshaw?
Oh, my gosh.
This is until the Eddie Guerrero match. This match right here is probably the Bradshaw performance.
Yeah.
If Bradshaw looked like this in every match, he would be the greatest Stan Hansen tag partner ever. And Stan Hansen had a lot of fake Stan Hansen tag partners.
Yeah.
He looked young, he was ridiculous.
Like, crazier Stan Hansen.
Yeah. He was as close to Stan Hansen as you can get without having Stan Hansen. He was ridiculous in this match. And God bless poor Too Hot Scott for drawing the Bradshaw card for of this match.
He gets obliterated in this. It is great.
Yeah, and I love, you can tell Christopher is like staying on the apron. Jerry Lawler on the apron is tremendous with his apron work. Because too much is the kind of gimmick, when I would be watching pro wrestling at home, too much is the picture-perfect gimmick that would make my mom look up from the couch from her book and just go, stupid, and then look down. She loathed wrestling. Her father used to make her watch Los Angeles Territory pro wrestling when she grew up. She hated pro wrestling. And then for her son to also get into pro wrestling was like, had to have been a nightmare. But there would be certain cartoonish WWF things that she would just look up from reading and just go, this is stupid, and then look back down. And watching too much here just tickled me, because it's the kind of thing my mom would just be annoyed by. And I love Lawler, while they're doing their annoying too much stick, standing on the apron and then looking at the crowd and pointing at too much like, huh? How good are these guys? aren't these guys the best?
Look at that smile. Look at that dance he's doing. I mean, Christopher is pretty good.
Yeah.
It's just a fucking, I mean, he is a hateable guy. I can't believe that guy ever worked as like a top of a territory babyface.
Yeah, Brian Christopher booked as a babyface is like when I heard Mexico Promotions book Zumbido as a babyface. And it's just like, oh, okay, that's weird, but whatever works for your, it's your money for the Fed, you know? But yeah, Christopher has an all-time punchable baby. Like, he has a punchable face.
Yeah.
And he knows he has a punchable face. And he works that punchable face. And it's just perfect. And then I love Funk tagging into the match and Funk calling out Lawler. Like, Funk wants Lawler. And Lawler being totally game, and them just working a great Lawler. These guys had great matches 8 years after this match, you know?
Ever since they had a great match in, like, 2013.
Yeah. And so I love that. How often does WWF point to an actual history-type feud?
Like, I know, it's weird, because, like, they had to say something about it.
Yeah.
The announcers are like, these guys, I remember a great match they had in the past.
Well, that's what's kind of funny, especially looking at it with modern eyes, is Kevin Kelly is on commentary, and he actually does a really good job about putting over the history of these two, and he knows how to put over Lawler's offense. And if you listen to any 1 minute of Kevin Kelly commentary nowadays, he's the worst. It is horrible listening him on Ring of Honor. It is terrible. I don't know how much of it is because Steve Corino on commentary is also terrible, but they are terrible together. And here, Kevin Kelly totally knows how to put over Lawler versus Funk, and it makes the match that much better.
I mean, there was it was a little bizarre that the first move Lawler hits on Funk is two pile drivers.
That's kind of WWE late 90s Lawler, though. Pile driver. I mean, you saw the Taz feud where he would start with the pile driver.
Yeah.
And
the callback pile driver by Funk is really great, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then Lawler gets to work in a big bump to the floor, which I think that's kind of the, you know, you and I have watched a couple Lawler matches in our time. And one of the trademarks of Lawler in WWF, for sure, is either a big bump on the floor or a big bump into the post. And obviously he did that stuff in Memphis, but they were much more peaks within a WWF match for him. Like, they were a big spot within the match, whereas they were just part of Lawler being Lawler in Memphis stuff. So he gets to work in the big bump to the floor, and, you know, Funk's banking his head off the announce table, and Lawler's great at sending his own face into various objects. Lawler's really great at that. And this is just, on uniqueness alone, this match was a favorite. Once I saw the match lineup, it's just like, this kind of match doesn't happen in WWF. And then when you see it executed exactly how you would want it to be executed, it was
weird. It was a very un-WWF kind of match.
I mean, you hear, you know it's weird because watching it, you're like, coming up next, we got some Headbangers versus the Oddities. Like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, they keep on putting over, you know, the Too Much Feuds handicap match with Al Snow and Head.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the everything they mention, you're like, oh, yeah, that's why I didn't watch Shotgun Saturday Night. Right, right. You know? And then this match is somehow just on there. Somehow it's three guys from Texas getting to work like three triumphant Texan heroes in front of other Texans.
Yeah. Against your Tennessee team. I think Scott Taylor's from Maine, but you know, whatever.
he's honorary Tennessee for the
honorary team. Tennessee in this match.
And yeah, it's just this is the kind of syndicated match that I've watched a lot of syndicated wrestling, and after a while, you think, well, all the gems are dead and gone, and then you see this in a match list, and you're like, what? Hold the fort. And it's wonderful. It's just the kind of stuff that you just like to return to after you forgot anything like it happened 15 years earlier.
All right. Yeah. Beautiful. Okay, so now we're going to go to commercial here.
Okay.
Real quick, and we're going to have some people tell you about other matches you can other podcasts you can listen to on the Place to Be Nation. And we'll be right back with our non-wrestling crate digs.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you, including Main Event, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super shows. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Phil Schneider's Digging in the Crates, and our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse. And join Pro Wrestling Only's Will and I on the Dangerous Alliance podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to enjoy as well. We feature the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., The Kings of Sport, led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops, and the TJ McClune Show, featuring great guests from around the world of sports journalism. PTBN also proudly features the Richard the Mailman Podcast, specializing in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN also is the home to tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Elner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's tag teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWO-PTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, we're back. Sorry to keep you waiting, Eric.
Problem.
Let's. Right now, we're at the part of the show where we're each going to recommend something that is unrelated to professional wrestling. We're going to dig in the crates of all the rest of the world and try to find something that people might not know about or might that you think is pretty cool, and it could be a movie or a book or a band or a political philosophy or
a new religion
podcast. anything you want. So I'll go ahead and start us off, Eric. What do you have? You were excited about this part of it. You're a man with the recommendations to give.
I wanted a recommendation from each form of media that you just listed, but I guess I'm going to have to come back and do other podcasts because
We'll do an all recommendation
podcast. All recommendation podcast. It's like the Oprah's picks.
Yeah.
The Oprah's picks. This is our Oprah's favorite things. This is Una Kaida's favorite things right here. My recommendation is a magazine, actually. Those are still a thing, and I love that they're still a thing in some areas. And this magazine
I would love it if it was just jugs. You're like, guys, you're looking at these ladies with some big titties.
Now I'm feeling stupid if it was actually Perfect 10 or something. Like, now I'm going to feel like a real dummy talking about Perfect 10. None of the women are 10s. None of them. Just jugs. Jugs is still going strong in 2015. The print medium hasn't died for jugs. Borders may be out of business, but jugs aren't.
Hey, jugs are never going to go out of business.
Jugs are never going to go out of style, everybody. Oh, my gosh. No actual recommendation I can say is going to be any sort of interesting right now.
My life is
just like going to be filled with regrets about not recommending jugs. Okay. Anyway, my actual recommendation is a magazine. It is my absolute favorite magazine. It is a quarterly. I've been subscribed to it for many years now, and it is called Shock Cinema.
Okay.
Shock Cinema. And it's all done by one guy out of his New York apartment with his wife. He's been doing it for years, probably 20 years, since the early to mid-90s. And he used to do interviews and movie reviews for the old Psychotronic Video, which was an old kind of cult movie genre magazine from the late 70s through the mid-90s. But Shock Cinema is kind of the perfect magazine for those actors and actresses that are those guys. You know, when you watch a movie and you're like, man, I've seen this guy in like a lot of things before. They're like rarely leading men, but they're those guys. And then you sometimes know their names, but then usually it'll only take a couple of, oh, he was in Goodfellas, he was in this, and you go, oh yeah, that guy. Well, this magazine celebrates those guys. And it gets interviews with a lot of these guys, and then does tons of movie reviews from movies that you've never heard of, movies that are impossible to find, book reviews. It is a labor of love, clearly, for this guy. Some example of those guys that are in the most recent issue. This is great because these guys are like on the cover, you know, and these guys are not cover type guys. One of my favorite actors, Richard Mazur, is one of the interviews. And he was in The Thing. He was in One Day at a Time. He was in Bride of Boogity. He was in The Believers. He's in, you know, you'd see him and go, oh, yeah, that guy. I know that guy, the guy with the mustache. And MC Gainey is interviewed in this.
Ooh, I like MC Gainey.
MC Gainey is great. You know, he was in Justified. He was in Con Air. He was in Breakdown. But where have you ever seen a long interview with MC Gainey? You know, he's a guy who's done some really cool stuff. And, the last issue had, Richard Anderson, who played, Oscar on The Bionic Woman and $6 Million Man. And he was in, Forbidden Planet in the 50s. He was in an early, Kubrick movie, Paths of Glory. It just finds these guys and, guys that you love, guys that are in stuff. And the reason I found the magazine was because I saw that one of the issues several years ago was interviewing M. Emmett Walsh, who is an all-time personal favorite of mine. I don't know if you've seen Blood Simple, the Coen Brothers movie. Phil?
Yeah, sure. Walsh is great.
M. Emmett Walsh is incredible. M. Emmett Walsh has the greatest voice of any actor. He's the and he's in everything. M. Emmett Walsh has played somebody's dad or grandpa or some sleazebag in everything. He probably has 250 acting credits. And so I saw that, hey, there's this magazine that had him on the cover. That's weird. That never happens. And then I read it. I found other guys, and it's awesome. You know, if you ever wanted a magazine entirely dedicated to people who played villains in Charles Bronson movies, you know, this is it. If you wanted to interviews with the guys that were in a bunch of Clint Eastwood movies with two lines in those movies. Oh, this is that magazine. And, it's great. And it's $5 an issue. It's they use great photos. It's not a half-assed operation. It's not like a Kinko's newsletter type thing. It's an actual legit magazine. A yearly subscription to it is $20. So, you know, $5 an issue. And it's great. It always has, I've never been disappointed by an issue. I always come out of it wanting to look up these guys to find which episode of TJ Hooker they played a rapist on. It seems like every guy on the issue played a rapist on TJ Hooker or a rapist on an episode of Rockford Files. And, you know, a lot of good gigs for guys that could be convincing rapists in the 70s and 80s. And it's beautiful. It's a wonderful magazine. It's every 3 months when it comes in the mail. It's like it's one of those things where I instantly just run inside, rip open the envelope, and just want to sit with it for like a few hours.
We will put a link to the website where you can order back issues and get a subscription.
Yeah, Shock Cinema.
Your guide to cult movies, art house oddities, drive-in swill, and underground obscurities is the tagline. That's a great tagline.
Isn't it great? The guy's been doing it on his own for 20 years out of his apartment. And it's
in Edgewater, New Jersey, is where the P.O. box is, which is a perfect spot for... Either he writes comics or maybe a nephew of
his. His wife does some comics.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
Yeah, Shock Cinema, it's great.
Shock Cinema, they have a YouTube channel too.
Yeah, he could be more dedicated to updating the YouTube channel, but the guy's kind of busy doing a magazine.
Well, if you ever wanted to see Jerry Lewis and Al Goldstein on AM New York, you'd see it on Shock Cinema's YouTube channel.
I think I forget if he posted it or not, but there's a great one of Ben Gazzara and Peter Falk and John Cassavetes just wasted out of their minds, I think, on the Dick Cavett Show. And it's just those guys who look like three guys who loved to get wasted together. And they clearly just got wasted and then went on the Dick Cavett Show. And so it's them just shooting the shit for 30 minutes. And, don't even get me started on how much I love Ben Gazzara, though, because then that's a whole nother podcast.
Great. Well, I'm going to give a recommendation for a band. And this is actually a band that's actually relatively close to my heart, because this band was actually a band that I saw in concert on the first date I had with my wife. So we're getting a little emo here on the Dignan Crates podcast. It was basically, I had sort of met Chelsea at a party and we chatted over email and I had sort of asked her out and was trying to look for a cool DC date to do, and thought a concert at Black Cat would be a cool place to go. And I wanted to see who was playing, and this band was playing, and I said I never heard of them, and I listened to some songs and thought they were pretty cool, and we had a very nice time, and then obviously ended up getting married, and they're sort of our band in a lot of ways, play one of their songs at their wedding, and the band's called the Minor Birds, and it's primarily a single person with some additional people that that she brings in on different albums and things like that. It's the woman is Laura Burren. She was in a band called Georgie James before that.
Right. And
it's kind of, she described it as wanting to make a Neil Young funk album. Which is actually how she got the name, because there actually was a band called the Minor Birds, an R&B band that had Rick James and Neil Young in it together.
When I told you that and you thought that I was a lunatic?
Yes, you did tell me that, and I did think you were a lunatic, and then I looked it up and I was like, oh, wow.
I was like, yeah, the Rick James band, and you're like, what the hell are you talking about?
You're like, the Rick James, Neil Young band? I was like, are you having a stroke? So they have just the band's got three albums. What We Lose in the Fire, We Gain in the Flood is the first album. Generals is the second one, and she just released a new album called Lovers Know, which came out in like last month.
Yeah, it's literally a month old. It's really good.
It's literally a month old. I would say that if you were a fan of most recent Tegan and Sara record or Haim, that would be in a similar world. I think it's hard to talk about music and describe it, but it's very, very sort of catchy, some very pretty songs, some very sort of catchy, dancey songs. We're going to play, a little bit of, the sort of, I guess, new single, if single is a thing that exists, off the new album, Lovers Know, Semantics. We're going to hear a little about that now. But a good band. She's on tour now. The show is great. And the album's really great.
Yeah. I liked the her first album is still my favorite. What We Lose in the Fire, We Gain in the Flood. And it really, for more of like a broader comparison, if people are, it really kind of reminds me of like, for fans of like Cat Power or Fiona Apple kind of stuff, or, even like, but even further back, like, I always get like a Linda Ronstadt kind of vibe.
Ooh, that's a good one.
From her. That's kind of the biggest, touchstone from, that I've gotten from her stuff. Linda Ronstadt seems, or, you know, Dusty Springfield seems like an easy one, but Linda Ronstadt, I think, seems appropriate for her style.
Okay. So we're gonna let's listen to a minute or so of Semantics, and then we'll come back and do some plugs and close it out.
Yeah.
Changing like water, but sometimes you're as hard as the ice in Siberia.
All right, some rock and roll.
Rock and roll music.
Hope everybody enjoyed that. We'll put up a link to the website with the tour dates and the album on our post on Place to Be Nation and on Segunda Caída.
And that that first album, the one that we had talked about, their albums are, it's like 30 minutes long, you know? These are easily digestible, high-end albums, you know? Like, I don't know. They're a good band. They're a good band that I could see being much bigger than they presently are.
Yeah, well, this will do it, I think. I mean, once you get the digging in the crates,
yeah.
Seal approval. I mean, this is, it's like being on Apple Beats One, right? I mean, on there, I imagine that what more is it going to take than to get a dedicated audience of fans of obscure wrestling to jump the bandwagon?
Once you get the niche wrestling crowd, you're set.
Yeah, this guy's character actor film magazine is going to be bigger than the New Yorker.
You know, there's a chance. I would bet money on Shuck Cinema being in print as a magazine longer than New Yorker.
Yeah, that could be.
That seems not, that wouldn't seem that shock. I think once all major magazines die out, the only ones that'll exist are stuff like Jugs and Shuck Cinema. Pretty sure that's gonna happen.
All right. Do you have any, thank you for coming on, my friend.
Yes.
Hope people enjoyed this. I think we're in on a good 115, 120 run time, which is a good for not your usual 3-hour marathons you get to hear on the Place to Be Nation, but a little short of some wrestling talk, hopefully people have some chance to check out. We'll put links to three of these matches on YouTube up there, and then the fourth one you're going to have to go spend your $9 and go on NWA Classics, but I guarantee that's $9 well spent.
Just that match. That match, the Hector Guerrero, Lothario, and pretty much all the Lothario. The Lothario alone is worth $9.
Oh my god! And a Junkyard Dog versus Butch Reed in a chain match. We're going to talk more about matches from the NWA Classic Series. We might talk about one per show until the podcast stops from now on. At this point, so Aaron, you got anything to plug?
I have two things. The first is obviously Segunda Caída. We somehow, almost 2 years on, have posted at least one thing, per day, which sounded like something that would realistically happen for 2 months, and somehow has gone on for 21 months. I don't think anybody is more shocked than ourselves.
Yeah, well, let's thank our buddy Matt D for coming in and joining us and consistently putting out something every
Matt D's been a lifesaver on some of those days where I had zero things planned.
Yeah, you had zero things planned, and Matt D had something that was ready to post Wednesday, and now it's going up Tuesday.
That was Tuesday's thing. Thanks, Matt. Sorry for ruining your Monday, Wednesday, Friday plans. Yeah, but I think we're in a good groove. I think we switch up what we write about enough. I don't think we get stuck in any sort of topic ruts. I think we're all good about, like, well, I think I'm bored about writing this. I'm going to start something new. And it's not always, you know, sometimes I go into, I'm going to write about New Japan. And then I realize, why am I writing about New Japan? And, but it's fun. There's always something new. I think there's a lot of content and it's exciting. So please check out the blog. I appreciate how much you guys have responded and how much our readership has, geez, quintupled more since we've been posting actually like a real blog. It's almost as if hard work pays off in some degree. Not that anything I've ever done related to the blog is hard, but it's time.
Never hate us in any way.
Yeah, and never made us one red cent off of it. I've gotten a couple of DVDs sent to me by loyal readers, which I love you. Thank you. And it's just nice. It's just nice to know that you take time to do something and you actually are enjoyed by people. So thank you. The other thing I'd like to talk about is a little bit more serious, a lot more serious, and we're going to have more information on this in the coming days. I live in Northern California, about 40 miles north of San Francisco, and our area is on fire, literally. There are the worst fires that I've ever seen in our area, and over the weekend, the fire burned over 60,000 acres and 1,000 homes, and completely demolished an entire town. It is not a large town, but literally nothing about that town exists anymore. The pictures look like Syria or something. It looks like nothing but rubble. And one of my coworkers lost her house that she actually was raised in, and was the most important thing to her. She had said she'd do anything in her life to keep that house, and it's gone. It's completely gone. She's lived there for over 50 years, and it just doesn't exist anymore. She had to relocate. Her people have tons of livestock out there, and they had to be evacuated so quick that the only thing they could do was open the gates to their livestock pens and hope the animals could get out to safety, because they had no time to actually save any of them. And it's horrible. I've never been up close to this kind of actual devastation. And it's kind of shaken me. And so in the coming days, we're going to be putting together some sort of fundraising. I don't know what we're going to do yet. I don't have tons of marketable skills. But something's going to happen because something needs to be done. This is probably the craziest thing that's happened of my life and my personal experiences. So I'll keep posted on this kind of stuff.
All right, yeah, great. Well, there was something up on the blog. I think there's been something.
Oop, you're kind of going a little muddy there, Phil.
We're going to put something up on the blog about that. We're going to have some PSAs on Place to Be Nation, and I'm from Northern California too, so I've got a lot of sort of, you know, that area is close to my heart as well. So hopefully we'll be able to, probably won't raise a lot of money, but maybe every little bit will help
people. And I don't know what I'm going to do yet, if it's, hey, if you donate a dollar, I will write about whatever wrestling match you want. If you want to hear specific talking points about a match and my personal opinions on anything, you donate any amount of money, I will gladly do any of that. If I have a record that you want, I will send you this record with a donation. You know, like I said, I don't have a lot of marketable skills. I am an accountant. But I am a government accountant, which is no use to anybody actual personal accounting needs, so I can't even offer any sort of accounting services.
If anybody wants me to explain a logic game on the LSAT to them.
Yeah, if you want
take the LSAT, there's a logic game that's confusing you. I'll do that via Skype for a donation. I want to, besides Segunda Kaida, I want to give a quick shout out to Aspen.us, 5 best ideas of the day. So if anybody's looking, we had some pretty cool ones today. Checking about the world around you. That's not got nothing to do with professional wrestling, but a lot to do with, you know, the
you know, the state of the world. So check that out. That's the other thing that I do sort of on the internet. And we'll be back, you know, soonish for another show. Hope everybody enjoyed this. Thanks to Will for doing the, for recording.
Thanks for the guests,
and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Yes. Thank you for having me. I love it.
And you don't stop, I keep on. 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 Yo, praise the Lord for showbiz. My partner with the beats, with the Nikes on his feet. Buying old records is a habit. I get more run than a Volkswagen Rabbit. You know I gotta have it. I got more props than the cop called McGarrett, who played on Hawaii Five-O and I formed a production company with Show and J Studio is the lab. But the session is closed, cause I know you got a big nose. Try to sniff out the name. You lack originality and that's a damn shame. Don't front, I know I got you open like a pack of tokens. Yo, I put your coat in. I'm not the one to be ganged on. I didn't know it was your girl we ran the train on. But no hard feelings, your girl was appealing. Did my share of dealing, sexual healing. You didn't know she was a groupie, but I'ma put you up on the scoopy. Used to live in Forest, my daughter lives on Morris. Used to play softball with my man Horace. I kick flavor like my man Sonny Chiba. Aries is my sign, I'm compatible with Libra. I like the program beats. Diamond D is out, I wanna say pay. Showbiz, there's deals to make. So let's get busy and dig in the crates.
I don't stop, you keep on.
Digging in the crates. Let's get busy.
Keep on.
Digging in the crate. Yo, thank the law for Diamond D. No afro instead, he keeps dreads in his head. My partner from the past, from 163rd back when I was a hoodlum, beating on nerds. It started way back when? About 12 years ago, I was 9, he was 10. Before smoking weed and hanging out and playing hooky, we used to break dance in the jams, electric boogie. Girls watch jockin', my nickname is Rockin'. The crowd, I was shockin', freaks, I was clockin'. Step up and see showbiz performing, my beats hit hard
like Big George Foreman.
So MCs and DJs who thought they were nice and get upset like Buster did to Tyson. That wasn't the plan, and he's still my man since he beat up Miss Green outside Dapper Dan. Wait a minute, that's a different subject. Talk about the Moet and the Pipers, that's in effect. Back to the show, the show B-I-Z down with D-I-T-C-A-G is my MC, relying on the giant not relying, never crying for the crack, cause I'm not a crack client. Girls stick like crazy glue, they think they're getting dope, but I treat hoes like drugs, I just say no. I lamp in a residence, so keeping dead presidents a fact. I like my pockets fat, not flat, flat. A rapper, not a singer, so hooker don't bring her. Pilot to me, so go ahead, you humdinger. Show's about to blow in 91, so I'm straight down with the crew caught digging in the crates. Digging it in the crate.
So get back, get your sticks and get your bats, get your licks and I'ma still get fat. Try to diss and get the back hand. I'm dressed in black, a black hat for a black man. The giant is better and clever. Go ahead and sleep and you'll rest forever and ever. I'm like a bomb, sometimes I'm calm. No telling what can happen once the mic is in my right palm. Me and showbiz too deep, but don't sleep. Go ahead and retreat or face agony of defeat. AG is in command. You remember the black hat at the bottom of my Timberland. Save it. If you think you pose a threat, just chill and watch how many hoes I get. Now you sweat the props I got.
Kick a rhyme.
A rhyme? Sure, why not? Always get fat to a hype track. So finesse.
What's up?
Psych, give me that mic back. The crowd I'll capture. Microphone master. Finger licking and kicking lyrics from here to Africa. I'm the bold kind. My rhymes are gold mine. Let it off. Set it off just for old times. Think you're ready for this. You wanna battle. Your music is riddle rattle. Your rhymes are scribble scrabble. The giant is greater, so I'm great. Down with the group called Digging in the Crates.
Yeah, yeah. We gonna set it off like this. D-I-T-C. Now when it comes to lyrics, mics are pulverized. It's law finesse, time to go for mine. So stand back, let the men play. I put rhymes in shape just like Bengay. I'm great and honorable, suckers I bomb a few. I run more games than a carnivore, I'ma get mine.
as soon as your city start. Sweat hoods and funky rhymes is my trademark. I'ma get fame not from her or his name, cause yo,
what's up?
I'm funkin' in a shit stain. Mics I smoke, rhymes I hurl. My hobby is collecting fly looking girls. Strictly for the ladies, call me Lord Finesse. And I'm all about money and sex. Finesse is the name to say. And I came to play. We could have fun, but put the whips and chains away. Sex and money is what makes me a happy man. And I sport more styles than Jackie Chan. I keep rising, I'm not the type to sink low. Me take a loss on a mic? I don't think so. Lord Finesse is out to make tapes. Down with the crew called digging in the crates. Digging in the crates.
Yeah, God, I'm such a sucker. I actually fell for your Paul Bosch racial gimmick.
That's not, no, that's the truth. I didn't make that up.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Wait, no.
Yeah.
That's legitimate.
Yep,
somebody literally saw his uncircumcised penis, and the jig was up.
That is my understanding of the anecdote.
Oh my God. I thought that was you knocking it out of the park with a hilarious joke. That is legit. Oh my gosh. That's absurd. That's amazing, but that is absurd. That's not very good commitment to the gimmick, though, I gotta say.
I'm trying to think of it.
Yeah. If you want to cash in the money on those Jews, you gotta put the hoodie down, man.
I'm trying to see whether I can find this online. Bosch himself comes in during the late 20s when Jack Pfeiffer discovers him working as a bodyguard. Deciding he likes life on the mats, Bosch rises fast and is crowned by Pfeiffer as the Jewish champion, replete with a phony belt. It mattered little to Pfeiffer if his Jewish champion is really Jewish or his Russian champion was actually Russian. Image is everything. That's how Paul Bosch, Gentile, ended up being presented to service as the Jewish champion. Do you look Jewish, one might ask, immediately leading to the question of, what does it mean to look Jewish? Apparently he did look Jewish, but Bosch was embraced enthusiastically by his audience, who surely would have spotted outrageous fake at any rate. All good things must come to his end, however, and Bosch's title run came to a rather embarrassing end. Tom Dirk told me a delightful story in that regard. Interviewed by the Jewish Daily Forward after a title defense, Bosch told the reporter, among other things, how proud he was to carry the laurels for his people and what it meant for him to be the Jewish champion. The interview over, the reporter left the story when Bosch hit the showers. As fate would have it, the reporter was checking his notes as he left and realized he missed a quote or two. He came back to the dressing room and inquired of Bosch's whereabouts, told the Jewish champion was in the shower. The reporter decided to wait. A few minutes later, his order was the biggest scoop of his life when Bosch emerged buck naked from the shower and showed the world he wasn't really Jewish. I didn't make this up!
Oh my gosh. I can't believe it.
It was a reporter for the Jewish Daily Forward.
That oh my gosh. I guess I should... Man, if I knew that level of detail, truly... Somebody could not make something that perfect up.
Ugh.
It's ridiculous, but oh my gosh. I can't believe it. I've not ever heard that. I thought for sure you were just being your usual hilarious self.
Well.
I did not even consider for a second that was legit.